And you're listening to Everything is Broken. I'm Jim Lynch, your host. And our guest today, Bill Felice, is on the line. He's professor of political science and head of the International Relations and Global Affairs Discipline at Eckerd College in St. Petersburg, Florida. And we're going to probably be all over the map here on our discussion, but we will focus on some of the main concepts he brought up in a terrific book that's published by Roman and Littlefield, and you can go to BillFelice.com for information on that. In fact, go to WSB.FM/broken, and you will have two links, one to Bill and I think one to for the book. Maybe not. Maybe I did it all under one. Either way, Bill, welcome to WSB, and welcome to Everything is Broken.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great. You're coming through loud and clear, so let's get going. Read a little bit about you from the bio, and there's more at the website, obviously, but let's hear more on the personal side. Where were you born and raised? Where'd you go to school? That kind of thing.
Born and raised in Seattle, Washington, and my undergraduate was at the University of Washington, and my PhD was at New York University, so went across the country to get my degree in international relations at NYU.
All right, super. My parents met at a University of Washington social function at the Cal Washington football game way back long ago. Anyway, so I've got a lot of roots in the Pacific Northwest and a soft spot in my heart as I sit here on the East Coast. You and I chatted and earlier and concluded that perhaps the broadest context of our discussion lies in the answer to the question, why you wrote the book. So why don't we get into that, okay, if we could, please?
Oh, sure. You know, this book, How Do I Save My Honor, it came about, really the genesis of it was back in late 2002 and through February 2003 when the Bush administration was trying to mobilize the country to go to war. And that during that time, I and many others, of course, were really concerned and thought that this was ill-advised for reasons that I think we'll talk about in just a moment. And there had been, as you might recall, and I think you were part of this, there were these huge demonstrations around the world.
Yep.
For the first time, there was a global movement before a war had begun to try to stop the war. And it was quite a phenomenon. And here at Eckerd College, the students organized a small demonstration to be part of that, and a few hundred people, and they asked me to speak, and I went to speak and gave some thought to it because the students, you know, were taking it very seriously, and I was very important to me, and did, you know, sort of laid out the case against the war, and thought it went well. Came back to my office, and on my answering machine was a death threat. That this is Florida, and you take those things seriously down here, that somebody had felt that I was a traitor and sympathizer to Al-Qaeda, and that it was a time to support the troops and to speak against the war was un-American, and he wanted to put a rope around my neck and hang me.
Wow.
So this was, you know, disturbing on many levels, obviously, but it really was caused me to think about the issues that this book attempts to elaborate, which are issues of moral responsibility, individual moral responsibility in a time of war, and that I was, you know, challenged by this guy, that I had overstepped the line. That as a professor I was abusing my position of power to indoctrinate students inappropriately during this time. And I think this was a very dangerous time in America back in 2002 and 2003. That you might remember that this is when Ari Fleischer, he talked about, the president's spokesman said, Americans should watch what they say and watch what they do.
Yeah, that was a chilling statement that still resonates, apparently.
A very chilling statement. And it was when the Dixie Chicks were attacked and run off the stage and their CDs were broken and become Dixie Chicked became a verb.
Yeah.
It was a time when commencement speakers who dared to criticize the president were booed off the stage. And so I guess part of what I hope my book does is to help people gain their ethical bearings so that in those dangerous times, that is when it is needed, I think, for all of us to find our ethical voices, our moral voices, and to speak out. After the war went badly, and by 2006, when there was the Mission Accomplished fiasco,
yeah,
George Bush, you know, then it became easier for people to speak out against the war. But when we were in those early days, it was very difficult to speak out, and many Americans did not speak out. And I wondered why people in the State Department didn't speak out. I couldn't believe they were supporting this effort. And so in the midst of this, I read this beautiful letter. You might remember it, by Brady Kiesling. He was the first State Department official to resign over the war in Iraq.
Okay.
And so this is back in March of 2003, as Bush is going to war, Brady Kiesling resigns. And I read his letter, and it really pushed me to do this study on individual moral responsibility. And I did it by going and interviewing him and interviewing the others, Ann Wright, John Brown, who resigned over the war, and I interviewed soldiers who refused to fight, Aaron Watada, Aidan Delgado, and then expanded to include people in Britain who resigned from the Blair government over the war in Iraq. And I really wanted to explore with them, you know, how did they protect their moral autonomy during war? How did they get the courage to really sacrifice their careers and their financial security to say, not in my name, not be part of this?
Right. The list of those that you interviewed is long and impressive, and both sides of the pond very well represented, and we're going to get into some of that in a moment. Again, to frame our chat today, Bill, let's back up a little. Some of the terms you've already used: moral integrity, moral autonomy, moral responsibility, all of these. Is there a way to differentiate that for people so they have a good feel?
Well, I think moral autonomy and moral responsibility really refers to each of us, our willingness to assert our own principled judgment and to take responsibility for good, right and wrong conduct. I think that it's that simple in a way. In many respects, for our individual lives, it is clear that we know that we should not murder, cheat, lie, steal, and so on. And we accept moral responsibility at that level for our individual actions. But when you turn to foreign policy, it gets harder, and there's this problem of many hands between you and the president involved in making those decisions. And so it's too easy to say, we don't have moral responsibility, you know, that's just the president. And then even in the State Department, officials who are formulating policies don't accept moral responsibility because it's just the president who is the elected representative of the people, and he has that responsibility. And so I think this differentiation between individual moral responsibility and then the government's moral responsibility is vast. And it goes back in political theory, of course, to Machiavelli and Isaiah Berlin and this idea that there's two moralities and the government has to have dirty hands to conduct its affairs. And I think that what I'm trying to argue in the book is that it is in our national interest for ethics to be considered key to foreign policy decision making. And for that to happen, it means the individuals in the government must assume moral responsibility for foreign policy decisions. If I could just give you a couple examples.
Okay, that'd be great.
To show this, I think if you think back, for example, some very big foreign policy disasters, think back to Bosnia. And it was very interesting. Eagleburger, when he was acting Secretary of State, as the deaths mounted and genocide was taking place, really over 200,000 people were being killed in Bosnia, Eagleburgers made a remarkable statement. He said, you know, if this was happening during the Cold War, it would have been in the national interest to intervene because the Soviets were supporting the Serbs, and we would have moved in immediately to stop the killing. But now that it's not, the Cold War is over, you know, stopping this genocide, or what they called acts of genocide in Bosnia, suddenly was no longer in the national interest. Think of that example, and think of the recent example of Henry Kissinger, which is in the press this week, when in the tapes that just came out,
yep, with
him talking to Nixon in the Oval Office about the Soviet Union and their treatment of the Jews, and Kissinger's talking about the immigration of Jews from the Soviet Union not being in the interests of the America the United States, and he makes the remarkable statement he says, if they put Jews into the gas chambers of the Soviet Union, it is not an American concern. Again, so ethics, to just an absurd degree, are set aside in his definition of the national interest. Or you just keep going through the Clinton administration and Rwanda. You know, key foreign policy advisor, Anthony Lake, national security advisor, never convened a meeting of the principals during the Clinton years over Rwanda. It just wasn't in the national interest to address the ethics of a genocide that was taking place in Rwanda. And finally, what the book deals with, of course, is Iraq. And here, I think you again have a situation where ethics are set aside to the point where Colin Powell, in the letter that he writes me, describes the debates on whether to go to war in Iraq and the debates on torture and the Geneva Conventions as policy decisions, not ethical decisions.
Right. That letter, to you from Powell, we'll get into that in a moment. I want to back up just a little bit.
Sure.
You mentioned Bosnia and Rwanda. The Sudan should get a mention. We even have a chance for a do-over with Sudan, as everyone is predicting. After their election next month, that there will be a civil war. And it's going to be interesting to see whether we're on the sidelines or what we're doing with that one.
Yeah.
Let's back up to the concept of a just war, because that seems to undergird a lot of the, at least the rhetoric. And we heard it from Obama as he tried to differentiate Iraq from Afghanistan. Can you touch on the just war? Where'd that all come about? Is that a U.S. concept, or is that just since war began way back?
Well, it's not a U.S. concept at all. I mean, it goes back to St. Augustine and in Christian theory, Christian theology, and different writers over time have elaborated just war theory. Michael Walzer, of course, is the preeminent scholar in the United States today on just war theory. Just war theory, it's often divided into jus ad bellum, which is the decisions to go to war have to be just. And then jus in bello, which is the justice of fighting the war. And one of the things that I found out in interviewing these people about why they resigned was that both of those categories, I think, they felt were violated. That the justice in going to war, jus ad bellum, I think it revolves around laying out really clear criteria for when war is justified and when it is not justified. And clearly war is justified in self-defense. It is justified if there is a imminent threat to you. But beyond that, war is not justified. You cannot. Preventive war is illegal and immoral according to just war theory. You can't just go to war to gain an advantage on another country. And anticipatory self-defense or preemptive war is only justified if it is absolutely necessary, if the threat is imminent. And George Tenet made it clear, and the former CIA director that Iraq never posed an imminent threat to the United States. So the criteria for Jusad Dhulam, for justification for going to war in Iraq, was never there. There is another category for the use of force that's being developed today in international law called preclusive war, which would fall under just war theory, which is the idea that you can intervene to prevent a humanitarian catastrophe.
Okay.
And this is related to R2P, the responsibility to protect, as they describe it at the UN. But this preclusive war would need to be approved by the United Nations. And again, in relation to Iraq, there was not genocide being committed. The gassing that occurred of the Kurds had the blessing of the Reagan administration, really, during the 1980s, because we kept selling him weapons while he was carrying out those actions.
Yep.
So these categories were used by many of the people I interviewed to justify their acts of resignation. In terms of justice in war, jusin bello, in terms of how you conduct yourself in war, there the violations, I think, of our conduct now have been well documented. You know, the foundational principles of international human rights law include the prohibition of torture.
Yep.
And arbitrary arrest and cruel, inhumane, degrading treatment. I mean, these are minimums that I never thought we'd be debating again.
Exactly.
Once again, after the intentional humiliations and torture that took place at Abu Ghraib and elsewhere, I think that led to many in the Army and Foreign Service to finally speak up, both within and then to, in some cases, submit their principled resignations.
Okay, let's set the stage for the audience relative to Blair and Bush, since you and their rationales for the invasions and occupations of these two nations. I mean, how was each nation different? Where were they in perfect or were they in perfect lockstep? My gut tells me that the process was different due to the parliamentary system and all of that over there, but the end result was the same. But could you make some distinction there, because you get into it in the book, and I thought that was an excellent part of the book, in that this isn't written from such a USA-centric point of view that we leave out what we laughingly refer to then as our allies. We thought they were duped, and were really, the whole thing became pretty silly as to this coalition of the coerced, we called it. But let's talk about Britain and about UK and the US, Bush and Blair.
Well, I think one difference between the UK and the US is, at least around Iraq, there was a much more of a robust debate in Britain on these issues. A much more honest debate. I think in the United States, it was the Iraq War became wrapped into 9/11, into defending ourselves from terrorists, and that debate was circumscribed here. That's one difference. Number two, I think in Britain there is a tradition in the government of resignation over principle, that such resignations over moral principle are not uncommon throughout the history of the parliamentary system of the United Kingdom. Part of that is a difference with the U.S. system, that the British cabinet members are drawn from the House of Commons and they can continue to serve as MPs even if they resign from the cabinet. And so it's you don't sacrifice your career by resignation, whereas here the people, Brady Keesling and Wright, John Brown, who resigned, they sacrificed everything. There was no place to fall back on to continue working for the government. And so there were people like that in Britain, Carney Ross and Elizabeth Winehurst, who resigned from the Foreign Service and suffered the personal financial setbacks and career setbacks there as well. But the main resignations occurred by people who were MPs serving in the Blair government. But the fact that they could do that meant, I think, that they had a more full discussion, and thus the debate and the vote in Britain to support Blair was very close in the end, and then he quickly lost support as the war did not go the way he thought. I think a final key difference, the way Blair thought it would go, I think a final key difference between Britain and the United States is over international law, and that Great Britain is a member of the International Criminal Court. Tony Blair was very concerned about the legality of the war, and so Blair convinced Bush to go back to the Security Council to try to get a final resolution that would legally then authorize the invasion of Iraq in 2003. He did not get that, and instead got his Attorney General to give him an interpretation of existing resolutions that were passed by the Security Council as justification for the war. But many, including Philip Sands in Great Britain, feel that was never a valid valid or correct interpretation of those resolutions.
You state that Britain is a member of the International Criminal Court. What about the U.S.?
The United States is not. We were part of the negotiations when the Rome Treaty was passed, but we have not ratified the treaty, and I think that it's not a high priority right now. It's extremely unfortunate that we don't do that. There's a great fear that among some, it's misfound that because America has a global presence with our military forces, that some of our troops would be called up for war crimes by third parties and sent to The Hague.
Right.
That would never happen. There's a principle in the Rome Statutes of complementarity, which gives the home country the first right and obligation to pursue war crimes charges against any individual, and they no country can bring charges if that country is pursuing it themselves.
Well, it's
U.S. soldiers would be well protected.
It's convenient for the nation that is positioned as empire to not be part of such a thing. I can see the pragmatic approach there.
One other aside on the International Criminal Court, however, the United States did ask the Security Council to pursue Sudan through the venue of the ICC. And so this could indicate that we're warming up to use the ICC as a forum for justice around these international issues.
Interesting. Before we get into, we may loop back around on this one as far as international law being broken, et cetera. The smoking gun relative to rationale, to me, was always the Downing Street memo. But in your book, you also point out the Butler Report, which was new to me, and I guess that leads me to my question. What was your take on the mainstream media during all of this? And are there USA documents that are equally damning? These are UK documents we're talking about, right?
These are UK documents, and at this moment, I think they are the most complete in terms of giving us an idea of what was happening at the time internal to the Blair and Bush governments. I don't know of their equivalent in the United States. Eventually, I'm sure other such documents will come out. I think what both the Butler Report shows and Carney Ross's testimony, I think, crystallized it, was that according to the British intelligence agencies, Saddam Hussein did not pose a direct threat to Britain or to the United States, and that this is one of the reasons Carney Ross resigned, that the intelligence was being molded to fit a political agenda to keep the British government in with the United States and going to war. So the Butler Report, I think, really revealed that pretty clearly. And then the Downing Street memos revealed how early the decisions were made and admitted that the intelligence was being fit, that the facts were being fit around around the decision to go to war, that it's quite revealing. And I was surprised that it didn't have more of an impact in the United States, quite frankly.
Yeah, there was a great attempt in the blogosphere and in the online community, but the mainstream media really took a pass on this one. Let's get into this. I really liked your whole recitation on the rewarding for duty concept, trumping morality. The example that popped right out, of course, was the Presidential Medals of Freedom ceremony that we all had to endure in seeing Tenet and who else was there? The general, I'm sure I'm blanking out on the names here, Bremer, Tenet, Bremer, and McGeorge Bundy, right? No, that was earlier. Wrong war. the fact is that Paul Wolfowitz getting rewarded also with the World Bank appointment. You laid all that out there. And this is kind of a neocon party here.
Yeah.
What does that tell us, this whole rewarding for duty trumping morality?
Well, I think the list of names you're just referring to, Paul Bremer, when he was the chief envoy in Iraq, was there during a time, when he disbanded the Iraqi army, putting 400,000 Iraqi soldiers out of work. It just fed the insurgency. He also, there was $9 billion missing on his watch. General Tommy Franks, he won the presidential...
That's the one I was missing.
...of freedom, and he's been heavily criticized for his poor war planning and the not taking into account the threat of irregular fighters. George Tenet, CIA director, of course, is the most responsible for the misleading intelligence, and he gets the Presidential Medal of Freedom. And Paul Wolfowitz, as you mentioned, gets the presidency of the World Bank, following in Robert McNamara's footsteps. Earlier I'd gotten that position after the Vietnam.
Yeah, connect the dots.
I think that what this is a reflection of is something I talk about at the end, which is the danger of loyalty becoming a vice instead of a virtue. That there's a privileging of loyalty, I think, in our system over all other norms, and that this has disastrous consequences. Here you had individuals who made a lot of mistakes, but what were they? They were loyal. They were loyal to President Bush, and so then they were rewarded accordingly. And I think that loyalty may be important, but it must be balanced with competence and critical thinking and fundamentally with maintaining one's voice and one's moral autonomy. I think what happens beyond that high level is that as you go down the ranks, what you see is this loyalty is infused and it infects behavior. And so you had literally hundreds of Foreign Service officers who disagreed with the Iraq war plans and going to war in Iraq, and they kept their criticism silent. When Anne Wright resigned, she received 400 emails from Foreign Service officers saying, "I wished I could do what you did. I wished I had the courage to speak up." But they didn't, and they had sacrificed their moral autonomy. Had they spoken up, I don't know if it would have prevented the war, but it certainly would have made it more difficult to move forward. Military officers, the same thing. They privately would oppose Rumsfeld's poorly thought-out plans, but they didn't protect their moral autonomy and weren't able to speak up because of loyalty. And it goes all the way down to all of us. Citizens, rallied around the flag as loyalty to the country at a difficult time instead of questioning this policy.
Well, you traced back to Nuremberg, and I thought context, you said that since the judgment in Nuremberg is no longer a credible legal defense or convincing moral argument to maintain that one was merely following orders. And again, back to your distinction earlier about public servants, military included, even taking oaths and that are specifically worded, that we as regular civilians don't have. Our obligation is to family, and that's about it.
And I think that's right. And I think what happens is it's a certain amount of moral numbness, I think is a phrase that might describe it, which is an inability for individuals to accept moral responsibility. We become numb to all this around us. Mm. And so it is part of it is linked back to our early discussions about two moralities, one for individuals and the other for the government. And so we separate, you know, our moral thinking from what the government does. And that, I think, we just become employees. We become cogs in the wheel. If we're in the Foreign Service, you know, we become numb to the moral implications of foreign policy in the real world.
Yeah.
And that, I think, does not serve the country well.
Yeah. Very good point. Well, I'm looking at the clock, and I want to make sure we can dive into Colin Powell here a bit. I'm afraid I'm gonna skip some of this that I wanted to get into. The concept of staying in versus resignation is critical here, and you gave examples in both the Brit side and the U.S. Either from your research for this book or subsequently. Can you characterize your gut feeling about how you'd characterize Colin Powell today?
Well, I think Colin Powell, I think his letter to me was very revealing, you know, which I've already quoted, when he says that these decisions were policy decisions and not ethical decisions. I think he lost his ethical bearings. And it's a tragedy in a way, because I think he was a decent man. I think he was a very popular individual in the Bush government, and he could have made a difference. I actually think it would have been hard for Bush to pursue the policies he did in Iraq had Colin Powell resigned. But Powell didn't even consider going in that direction. He had two meetings with Bush about the Iraq War, the famous Pottery Barn meeting that Bob Woodward describes when he tells Bush, if you break it, you own it, and one other meeting. But beyond that, he doesn't say much, and he doesn't really try to talk Bush out of war. And he then, as we know, becomes the chief cheerleader for the war, making more statements than Cheney that were wrong about weapons of mass destruction in Al-Qaeda, if you total them up, which I document in the book.
Yep.
And he goes to the UN and gives his infamous speech demanding that the UN support the war. So despite his reservations then, I think where his moral failings really come when he takes on this role as chief salesman for the war. One of the things that's interesting, I think, is to compare his actions to Clare Short. And Clare Short was a high up in the Blair government in a similar position. She was Secretary of International Development, like the third highest cabinet member in the Blair government. And Robin Cook, his foreign secretary, had resigned already to protest the war. And if you compare what Clare Short did to Colin Powell, I think the difference is remarkable. Clare Short at first also did not resign, and like Powell, she tried to work from within, even though she thought there was a rush to war. But she was able to get two promises out of Blair and Bush, which were, number one, to internationalize the reconstruction of Iraq, to turn it over to UN, to the UN, and number two, to revitalize in the Middle East, the roadmap for peace. And so because she had their ear and got their commitment, she stayed in the government. 3 months later, when Blair violated his agreement with her and Bush violated his agreement with her, and they weren't going to do either of those things, she then resigned. And she didn't continue to be a cheerleader for a policy that she didn't support, as
right.
Colin Powell did. So I think with Claire Short, you see someone who exemplifies the best, really. She, because he shouldn't always resign.
Yeah, she gave it the old college try.
Exactly. She stayed in. She tried to make it work when it was clear she was being lied to. Then she submitted her principled resignation.
Right.
Now, she got beat up by the left for not resigning initially in 2003, and then got beat up in a few months later from the Laborites for not standing with Blair in a moment of crisis. And so she took a lot from everybody. I think she maintained her moral autonomy and moral integrity, and as an example, a positive example, as opposed to Colin Powell, who I think really lost his bearings.
Yeah, personally, he remains the biggest disappointment and the most immoral, in my opinion, in the cast of characters. Cheney and Bush never sold anyone on their faux morality. Their sneers and snickers, I think, told it all. But here was Powell, once spoken of as a real chance to be the first African-American president, and just imploding right before our eyes. Even the supporters of the war must have had a sick feeling in their gut about all that, because he had some momentum going there, and he trashed it. Simple as that. But anyway, that's my keeping me out of this. When you look back at some of this, and I want to wrap it up, do you focus on the neocon ideology that was in play that as a principal driver of policy at that time, and how it affected moral and ethical decision making, or do you stay out of that side of it?
I think the neoconservative ideology of a muscular foreign policy and their criticisms of Clinton as being weak and their obsession with Saddam Hussein, I think all of that is background, definitely, and pretty key in the case of Wolfowitz to why we ended up going to war in Iraq. You know, in the end, it's hard to know. There's a whole list of reasons they gave as to why we needed to invade Iraq in 2003. Wolfowitz argued weapons of mass destruction was the one that, you know, would sell the best to the American people, and people could, inside the government, could rally behind. Whether that was really their motivation, given what we knew from the weapons inspectors, I don't know. I do know some of them, I accept them at their word, that they really thought that a democratic Iraq could be a model for other countries in the Middle East, and they wanted to bring democracy to the Middle East. It was ill thought out, as Wayne White in the book demonstrates pretty clearly. He was in the intelligence unit in the State Department debunking their democracy theory. But that was definitely behind some of their motivations for invading at that time as well. What's interesting is all of those arguments were strongly opposed by many inside and outside the government, but yet they went ahead.
Right. We hung on to that during the Bush-Cheney years, that there was only a small handful of true neocons that were in the inner circle, but it seems all you need is a few, and especially when you have Cheney and Bush's ears. So if you could just real quick before we wrap it up, tell me why neocons think Clinton is weak when he declared, how many days of bombardment in the Kosovo, Bosnia thing? 14, 21 days? He went to war.
I
thought they love war.
Arguments stemmed a lot around Iraq, and that he was weak in not moving more forcefully against Saddam Hussein.
Okay.
I think that in general has been a Republican argument against
Okay.
Strong on defense.
Yeah. Again, we've been speaking with Bill Felice, and he is professor of political science and head of the International Relations and Global Affairs discipline at Eckerd College. I'd love if we had some time to get into Eckerd College. I was on your website checking it out. A unique place. And
yes, you should come down.
I've got to see something like that in action, or a small school takes a mission that's a little bit different with the international emphasis in going overseas and all of that. Really,
One thing, at the beginning you said my website was BillFelice.com.
Yeah, I was wrong. I apologize.
WilliamFelice.com.
William, yes.
And I'd love it if people visited.
Yes, let's do that. And I want to thank you so much for being on the program.
My pleasure.
And we will talk again down the road, okay?
Okay. Thanks,
right.
Jim.
Thank you, Bill.